please the court. My name is Mindy Lester, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Robert Hopkins. Essentially, I believe there are four issues before the court, though like most custody cases, they're fairly intertwined. There's the issue of whether or not the district court erred in failing to find that there was a material change in circumstances pursuant to Nebraska Revised Statute 43-2933. I would submit to the court that the statute requires that finding be made once there's proof that there is a sexual offender who's required to register under the Act for a conviction for a felony of an assault of a child. Those standards were all met here. The second issue is whether or not the district court erred in failing to find that there was a significant risk of harm to the two minor children in this case, Alexis, who was 15, and Hadley, who was 13. Finally, the last two issues are whether or not the court erred in failing to consider the best interests of the minor children at all, and in failing to find whether or not the best interests of the minor children required that the father be granted custody. I believe that the district court erred in all of these ways, and that I've demonstrated that through my brief, but I'd like to focus today on whether or not the district court erred in failing to find a significant risk of harm to Alexis and Hadley due to the presence of their stepfather, Thomas Rott, in the home. As I believe the court should be aware, Mr. Rott was convicted of sexually abusing his prior 14-year-old stepdaughter over a period of 2 years and was sentenced to a number of years of prison time for those felonies. He served 4 years, and he completed some sexual offense training while he was in prison, but he is required to register as a sex offender for 25 years under the statute. At no point in time did Kyle Hopkins, now known as Kyle Rott, or Thomas Rott, advise Mr. Hopkins that she was living with and had then married a sexual offender. In fact, it wasn't until after the filing of our answer in this case that that information was found online. The court determined that Mr. Rott doesn't present a risk to these children, despite the fact that at 13 and 15, they're essentially the same age as the 14-year-old stepdaughter from his prior marriage who he assaulted. The court blatantly stated that they were relying on Joan Schwann, who was the children's counselor, to come to that conclusion. Ms. Schwann testified that she only provided counseling service to Alexis and Hadley after the filing of this case, and that she never provided any services to either Kyle or Thomas. More importantly, she never met Thomas. And most importantly, she testified very clearly with no prompting that she was not qualified to give any recommendation on whether or not Thomas Rott is a risk to reoffend. She was very clear that she only works with juvenile sex offenders, not adult sex offenders, and could not provide any information about whether or not Thomas was a risk to reoffend. So with that information alone, the court abused its discretion in finding that they could rely on Ms. Schwann to say that Mr. Rott was not a risk to the children. She said she couldn't tell the court that, so I'm not sure how the court came to that conclusion based on Ms. Schwann's testimony.
So our standard of review here is abuse of discretion.
I believe it's a de novo standard of review on the record, right. Yes, Your Honor.
So is it your position that his status is like a strict liability argument, that in and of itself the conviction, notwithstanding what may have occurred since then, automatically is a material change in circumstance, and he and under no circumstances can he continue to be in the home and be a parent to the children?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe the Watkins case and the statute both say that very directly. And I think that was the purpose of the statute. Where you are a felony, convicted sexual offender, required to register, you cannot live in the home with children. And the Watkins case says it's a statutorily deemed change of circumstances, and custody shall not be granted to the person who resides with the sex offender, absent a showing of no significant risk. So the first step is absolutely, this is a strict liability issue, you cannot live with them. Unless, and unfortunately there's a but even with that but, Kyle Rott had the burden to prove there was no significant risk, and she didn't do so. The only person she brought in was Ms. Schwann, who said, I can't tell you if he's a risk.
But didn't Ms. Schwann testify she did not perceive a risk to the children? And she testified about the actions that the parents had taken to ensure privacy for the children and limit any time alone with the stepfather?
Her testimony was that she had not been made aware of any red flags, but as we went through the trial, a number of red flags came up that it was clear she wasn't aware of, such as Alexis would spend on more than one occasion several hours alone hunting in the woods with Thomas. Thomas himself identified that that would be a risk for him, but then admitted to doing that with the explanation that he was only 2 miles from home. I've submitted to the prior court, and I'll submit to this court, 2 miles is plenty of space to sexually assault a child. Ms. Schwann did provide the court with essentially a roadmap for how to determine if there were risk factors. That was not keeping secrets. We know the girls kept secrets. Even when they were told by their counselor to share with their mom some very intense anger outbursts that Tom had, they didn't do so. Furthermore, if grooming is happening effectively, as Ms. Schwann testified, they wouldn't have told their mother, and they wouldn't have told the court and two attorneys they didn't know in chambers. That's what grooming is. It's finding out whether or not they'll keep secrets. There was also the issue of being alone, and all four girls living in this house enjoyed hunting. But Alexis was the only one being taken into the woods alone to do that. That's the special favors that Ms. Schwann talked about, and finding special time to be alone with a child to see what can happen. I would submit that that's absolutely grooming behavior that Ms. Schwann didn't even know was happening. What she did testify to was that Kyle herself is the victim of sexual abuse. Thomas testified that he was as well, and that she had grave concerns about Kyle's ability to see red flags because of a failure to address her own sexual abuse. Kyle didn't do it. She repeatedly told Ms. Schwann that the sexual abuse Thomas committed was the result of a bad divorce. She didn't take any responsibility for what the man had done, nor did he throughout the case, and that she preferred to push those actions to the back of their mind because no woman wants to imagine their husband doing that. So she was ignoring it. Ms. Schwann recommended repeatedly more than a year prior to trial that Kyle seek individual counseling to make sure that she wouldn't ignore the red flags, because that's what Ms. Schwann said victims of abuse do. They ignore it when it happens to their own children. And so she recommended counseling, and Kyle refused to do that. She refused to take those few steps that most of us as mothers would readily and happily do to make sure that our children are safe. She didn't do any of those things, which isn't surprising given that she moved in with a man she knew had sexually assaulted another child 3 months after meeting him with four of her own daughters. Ms. Schwann's testimony made clear that she couldn't guarantee the safety of these girls. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No, I'm listening.
Okay.
I guess what I in my mind, it did look like I have a question, and the question is, so we have this testimony from Ms. Schwann that while she didn't see any perceived risks, she also gave testimony that could support an argument that there potentially could be risks. And then we have the testimony of Kyle and Tom about the things they do to limit any potential risks. So where does that leave us in terms of viewing the evidence? Do we give deference to the trial court who saw and observed the witnesses in this case?
I don't believe that you can in this case, for the simple fact that she relied on Ms. Schwann's testimony. That's what she said. She didn't say, I relied on Kyle and
Tom. I think significant weight, not total weight.
Yes, certainly. But Ms. Schwann said she couldn't provide that. Tom and Kyle said that they took the bathroom door, or the bedroom door, the bathroom door they added a lock to, excuse me. They didn't ever tell the girls why there was a lock. My children don't lock the doors in our house because they don't know there's a reason to. They testified that the girls aren't allowed to wear swimsuits or have to be careful because it might encourage Thomas to do something to them. It's not in the best interest of children to be raised in a home where they have to worry about whether or not they're going to sexually arouse their stepfather. It's simply not. And he acknowledged that that was an issue. I can appreciate that they were trying to limit that risk, but I don't believe that our state policy is that we're okay with it if it's limited. There was no proof that there was no significant risk. The Watkins case involved a sexual offense that was a misdemeanor, and it involved, the court very specifically said, the mother testified that she had not allowed unsupervised contact. And because the children were never unsupervised, the Nebraska Supreme Court was okay with them remaining there. That's not the case there. He's unsupervised with them every morning for at least 2 hours before school. He's unsupervised with them in the evening, and he's spending time alone with them in the woods. They're not protecting them. They're not taking any of the action. They're not seeking counseling. They're not forthcoming about the crimes. Mr. Rott told his own hunting friend at the same time Kyle moved in that he was falsely accused and none of it was his fault. So that doesn't make me feel like he learned anything from whatever sexual offense classes he's taken, because he's not taking responsibility for the claims now. Even aside from that risk, which I believe is a substantial risk, the court didn't consider the best interest of the minor children, and I believe that this statute requires you do that. The statute requires immediately that you find that there's a material change in circumstances. And substantial risk of offense aside, that triggers the Parenting Act and the requirement that the court look at the best interest. I think there was ample testimony that the best interest of the child required the children's custody be changed, Thomas Rhett aside. So I'm out of time.
Isn't it implicit in the statute that if you have to evaluate whether the children are at a significant risk of harm, you are evaluating their best interest?
I think the statute is asking that you evaluate whether or not they're at risk of harm from Mr. Rhett, but she never evaluated the relationship between Robert and his children and whether that was facilitated by the mom. And the other very poor choices that the mother had made over a number of years that were substantially affecting her children, and she really, although she says she gave some consideration to Hadley's preference to live with her father, there's no discussion of that. They seem to simultaneously say she can't make any decision because she's not of the right capacity, but we're certain she'll tell us if her father's assaulting her. It was very conflicting in the order. Sometimes we believe her and sometimes we don't.
Thank you.
How much time did we take the appellant over? Would you please add a minute to the appellee's time? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Nick Volley on behalf of the appellee, Kyle Land. We disagree with the appellee's characterization and emphasis placed strictly on some differences of opinion with Ms. Schwann's testimony. If we start back just a little bit before we get to Ms. Schwann's testimony, I do think that it's important because it does parallel the case cited by the appellant, the Watkins case, because Mr. Land, or Tom, was convicted back in 2003. He then was incarcerated. He completed more services than would have been required for an early release. He was very detailed on his testimony as to what he did in order to effectuate a change. He then, in 2010, meets Kyle, and she moves in fairly quickly, there's no doubt. And then we get to trial four years later. So we have an 11-year span of time that history tells us there was no, to our knowledge, incidences or problems after the services were accepted that were offered to Tom. There were no law enforcement contacts. There were no contacts by CPS. There were no issues through the therapeutic process later raised by the children in terms of we're afraid of him, we're scared of him. There was nothing indicated to Judge Harder during the in-camera questioning that they were anything but comfortable or felt safe around Tom. The other thing that I think is important in terms of the facts as they progress through trial is there's no doubt that Kyle and Tom don't get along. That's one of the things that they agreed to, that they don't get along whatsoever. But there's a couple other things that
That's
they agreed
to. That's so unusual.
Yeah, I know. But there's a couple of other things that they agreed on. Number one, that both children were happy, healthy, well-adjusted kids. If we're talking about best interest, which we should, that's always been said to be the overriding factor in a court's charge is to determine what's best for kids, that's an important factor, that both parents agree that they're happy, healthy, well-adjusted kids. At one point, Robert also testifies that he thinks that the kids have a healthy relationship with Tom. So at some point, we've got to say they're doing pretty good. They're doing well in school. Robert also agreed that he thought that Kyle was doing a pretty good job. I think the issue was that she was disciplining appropriately. They may have some parental differences or strategies in terms of the number of chores that we do or the responsibilities that we give them. So I think that there is a lot of information regarding best interests and as it relates to the assessed risk. Because really, when you funnel this particular case down, whether we're talking a material change in circumstances or a change in circumstances, we're assessing what risk this individual is living with these kids. Because if a court does determine that there is a significant risk, then they ought to change something. I mean, I think that that only makes common sense. In this case, the court did heavily rely on the objective professional that had been dealing with the children for a year, talking with them. She said, I'm monitoring that. I'm familiar with the red flags. She testified, I think they have good boundaries. Okay. We have 11 years that there hasn't been a problem. There's been ample evidence as to the services that he has been provided. Was there an expert that came in and provided some sort of psychological assessment that he is not a risk? No, there isn't. I don't know that there is one. There isn't any information in the record that there is. But we didn't rely on that in meeting our burden of proof. There's no doubt we had the burden of proof under the statute. But by the same token, there's a lot of evidence that those kids are doing well and not afraid of him, and that there aren't issues regarding his risk. They are taking precautions. Now, opposing counsel does bring out some issues. Like, I think the testimony was one or two hunting trips, and I could be wrong. But I'm not here claiming, nor do I think anybody would, that these parents are perfect, because they're not. So in retrospect, if we look at what they did or didn't do, yeah, maybe they could have done better at some other things. I think the same is true of Robert, and I think that he testified as to what those things are that he maybe could have done better. Because if we're assessing best interests, ever since those kids were in Holdridge, he never went to a parent-teacher conference because he said the school wouldn't give him the information. He didn't know his youngest had an IEP. There was a not-so-nice reference to Kyle when the phone would ring on his cell phone. He admitted that he would say derogatory things about Kyle in the children's presence. He would call Kyle really some vulgar names. Now, by the same token, Kyle would respond. And again, they don't get along. Neither one, you know, should be doing that. There's no doubt. But by the same token, we still come back to the bottom line. The kids are doing well. Robert said they were. The school says they are under their grades.
Just so I'm clear, Ms. Schwann was the only expert witness called by either side?
Yes.
Was there ever a request by the other side for some type of psychological evaluation of your client?
No.
And the argument is that Ms. Schwann admitted she was not trained in determining risk of harm to the children. I believe that's the argument. So that the court erred in putting considerable weight into her testimony.
I don't believe that that's the case, and the reason that I say that is because at least the record doesn't reflect that there's any one sort of assessment that's going to tell us whether he is or not. It isn't a black and white kind of thing. If it was, you know, society would have an easier way of dealing with things. Number two, the statute doesn't require that I meet the burden of proof with an expert. Now, in some cases, that may be beneficial. But like in the Watkins case, they said it had been 10 years since the conviction. In this case, it had been 11 years. In the Watkins case, they said the kids didn't feel afraid, didn't indicate that there was any problem or anything going on, and the same as in this case. So what Joan Schwann testified to was the issue surrounding what do you look for if somebody's grooming, because we want to catch it before the sexual offender relapses. Now, opposing counsel at trial and today kind of wanted to, I think, characterize that as urges, and I'm not sure that necessarily works that way, but be that as it may, what we're looking for is to stop something before it occurs, those risk factors. And those risk factors, she said she was familiar with. It's the cues, it's the grooming and what all of that entails. Tom testified to that too. Tom testified how he groomed his victim back in 2002 and 2003. That's a lot of what it seems like the Department of Corrections through its services also goes through in changing that mindset and that control in trying to effectuate a change so that it doesn't reoccur. That's why Kyle and Tom put into effect various boundaries in the home in order to make sure that nothing happens. Is any one absolutely necessary? No, probably not. Again, people aren't perfect. But also, in the brief, I went through a lot of information as to who these kids are, because it seems to me that they have the information, they have the knowledge, they have the outside support group through their school, through their father, through their therapist, through their comfort level, and talking with both their mother and their father to say something if anything is making them feel uncomfortable. Should Kyle have said something different in 2010? Should she have done it a different way? I think Joan Schwan said, I didn't meet them back in 2010. I don't know if they were emotionally able to handle that or not. They may have been, they may not have been. So, yes, can we stand back in retrospect and say she didn't do it perfectly? Yes, we can. Can we say that about Robert? Yes, we can. Does that mean that there is a substantial risk of harm? No, I don't think that it does. I think Judge Harder was perfectly capable of assessing the demeanor of the witnesses, how sincere Tom was, how much information and the conviction that Ms. Schwan had in terms of her work with the children, having gone over all of the information that she received from the Department of Corrections, and his conviction and everything that had occurred.
Do you agree with the appellant insofar as asserting that the court made no determination or finding whatsoever regarding the best interest and the actual court order that there's no specific finding regarding best interest?
I don't think that Judge Harder specifically says, I find it's in the best interest. I think that that's true. I do think that it was assessed throughout the whole process in assessing all of the testimony. And I think part of that also comes in from Robert's own testimony as to what his concerns are. Because again, as you boil it down, if you listen to some of his complaints that happened 3, 4, 5 years ago, it really boils down to Tom's in the house. That was the issue that he had. Because he testified, Kyle disciplines all right, she loves the kids are doing a good job, the kids are happy, healthy, well-adjusted kids. And so then really, because the kids are happy and doing well, the issue seems to be, is there a risk to them? Because absent that risk, it seems like I'm out of town.
Okay. Yes, you are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Valley. And Ms. Lester's time is expired, correct? Yes. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Your case is submitted.